always elusive and indefinable, changes. That we experience in our mind and our body when we're practicing meditation for many hours during the day. Somehow everything becomes more alive. We become much more sensitive. Hearing becomes more acute. More aware of things around us. And at the same time as that sensitivity, then there's also a greater degree of depth. So it's not just sort of sensitive like a raw wound is. There's a weight to it, a gravity. A feeling that our mind is starting to somehow go down into the depths. And a feeling that even though it may be still imperfect, still partial, still immature, but we can now and then catch glimpses of insight, glimpses of the truth. Becomes more sensitive like this, we feel everything more. Life becomes more vivid. Everything is more real. Colors are more colorful. Tastes are more tasty. Emotions are more moving. Important that we understand that this process is going on not just in ourselves but also in those around us, the people sharing with the retreat. remember that each person is going through their own journey, that they're in their own way, at their own pace. So we need to be extra careful to respect their space, not intrude, not impose ourselves. To have that trust that each person, through reflection, through wisdom, through understanding, is in that process of discovering their own truth. When we start out this journey, this process, we don't know where it's going to lead. That's what transformation means. We become something unexpected. Ago, I spent the rains retreat in a cave monastery in Ipoh in Malaysia. And for that retreat, before the rains retreat, we'd built a new hut, a new kuti, inside the middle of this mountain. We'd created this tunnel, gone through into the heart of the mountain, made this meditation hut in there. It's quite an extraordinary thing. And then for the rains, after we'd done all that work, then we put a gate over the entry to where the hut was, and because of the kindness and the generosity of the people there, I was able to spend the 3 months of the rains just staying in the hut. And just someone would bring food every day. So while I was staying there, I'd get my water from a rainwater tank. And one day when I was there, I poured some water out into a bucket, and there was some mosquito larvae in the bucket, in the water. And if you've lived in tropical countries, then you'll know that this is a very kind of normal problem. If you leave any water exposed for any period of time, then you're going to get these little mosquito larvae. In Thailand, they call them lub nam, who means literally means water babies. And so these little wrigglies in the bucket of water. Wriggling around, perfectly happy. But of course, it's extremely annoying for me. Because if I'm a monk, I can't kill them. So what do I do with these little water babies? Normally, if we find the mosquito larvae in some water like that, we'll take it to a body of water, like a pond or something, and pour the water in there so that we don't kill them. But because I was staying up in the middle of the mountain, there wasn't any water nearby. Actually, it wasn't that far away. To find a stream, actually, it wasn't really the distance. It was more the terrifying thought that I might actually see a human being on my way to the stream that was more keeping me from doing that. So, when these larvae came, I just didn't know what to do. I just kind of got annoyed with them and just left them there. I thought, oh, maybe tomorrow I'll take them down to the stream. And one or two days went by, and I looked and I realized that these little mosquito larvae gradually were changing. Because when they're first there, they're white, pale color. And gradually these little kind of black bits started appearing on them. Oh, that's kind of interesting. And I started looking at them, and then I come out the next morning and, oh, they've changed even more, and they've kind of got mostly black, and you can see them actually starting to take on mosquito shape. And then one day I came out and all of them had gone except for one. There was only one left, and that had turned into a mosquito and was just standing on the surface of the water. And I felt so proud. It's my little babies. It's so wonderful to see that they'd achieved this amazing transformation. And I could see this one was getting ready to fly. So I was like, okay, here, come to Daddy. Come here. If you want something to eat, here you go. But it didn't. Just it took off, flew off. Bye bye. See it going off into the distance. A whole big new world to explore. Imagine that, yeah? All your life, all you've ever known is a bucket of water. And then this whole world out there, you fly off. So that taught me a very good lesson on that retreat. A lesson about patience, a lesson about not getting annoyed with mosquito larvae. It's a very useful one. But mostly it taught me this lesson that transformation happens. Transformation happens. We don't have to kind of force it. We don't have to worry about it. It's happening all the time. And so the Buddha said, impermanence, one of the characteristics of all things. We're all changing all the time. Our minds are changing. All of the conditions, all of the thoughts, the ideas, the experiences, the wisdom, everything that we've done in our life, everything that's been done to us, all of that is somehow there, it influences, it's all working its way in our consciousness, changing, conditioning, evolving, growing. And this is one of the great characteristics of the Buddha's way of teaching, that he wasn't about like forcing things to be this way or that way. But it's more you just kind of, you get engaged in that process of conditions. You kind of nudge things one way or the other. We can incline them. We can influence them. We can suggest. And that power of suggestion, if it's done gently but persistently, then our mind will go in the right direction. We can see in that example of the mosquito larvae changing into mosquitoes, that there's a progression there, there's an evolution, there's an expansion. We normally don't think of mosquitoes as being particularly evolved consciousnesses. I guess maybe that's more, says more about our prejudices than it does about mosquitoes. But you can see that there is a bigger world, a growth into a bigger world. And that's one of the characteristics of spiritual growth, emotional growth and spiritual growth generally, that we move towards a comprehension of a bigger world. You know, we know from the Buddha's teaching, he's always kind of talking about this thing, the sabbe sattā, all beings, in every direction. He talks about the mind which is vipulized, like abundant, grown great, mahagata, apamana, measureless. So there's always this idea of this abundance, this overflowing, this mind that's universal, non-dual, adwayam, infinite, anantam. All of these words we find to use to describe the mind in meditation. So we shouldn't think of our meditation practice as being like a constriction. And I think sometimes it kind of feels like that. It feels like we're being told to concentrate, and like we make our minds smaller. We're told all of the things we shouldn't think about. Which actually includes everything. Don't think about anything. The Buddha never said don't think. He said don't think unwholesome thoughts. And he said just you think skillful or wholesome thoughts, but you also be aware that as long as you're thinking those skillful and wholesome thoughts, that the mind won't go to deep concentration, to deep stillness. He didn't say there's anything wrong with those thoughts, but he just said there's something deeper, there's something beyond that. So one of the principles, one of the underlying tenets of this metta meditation is that we're moving from something smaller, more limited, towards something which is greater, which is limitless. And I think all Buddhist practice is orientated in that way. It moves from the small, the limited, the mundane, the everyday. And there's a strong emphasis. All real Buddhist practice is a strong emphasis on being with that grounded reality. So you don't just Buddhist practice is not about ignoring the mundane. It's not about ignoring the everyday. That's all part of it. But then we move gradually, we build on that, expand and expand. In the metta meditation, we've started with metta for ourselves and then metta for a loved person. And I think it's probably true enough, maybe a little bit cynical, but probably true enough to say that for most people in their lives, that's about as far as we get. Many people, the sphere of moral concern doesn't really extend much beyond that. That may be unduly negative, perhaps. But certainly that's when we speak about love, when we speak about caring. For most people, that's what they think of. Themselves or their immediate family, friends. And even though we have beautiful teachings in the various spiritual traditions, love your enemy, and so on, it seems to be hard enough to find people who actually do that, put that into practice. So, if we want to move our sphere of concern, expand our consciousness beyond ourselves and our immediate family, and using this method, we move next stage to the metta for a neutral person. Now, the category of neutral people in the world is a lot bigger than the category of loved people. It's about 7 billion people bigger. Paradoxically, it's a lot harder to think of a neutral person than it is to think of a loved one or a hated person. Actually, it's often difficult to stop thinking of loved ones or hated ones. And then you try to think of someone who's neutral and you go, neutral. Who's neutral? And you can't think of anyone, and that's the point. The Buddha said that the counterpart of neutral feeling is ignorance. Yeah. So we tend to pay attention to that which we like or dislike, and we tend to ignore those things we don't care about, we're equanimous about. And that's actually a very deep and a very important aspect of developing insight. And that's why the profound levels of insight meditation are always based on equanimity. very important. So in developing this stage, we're not only improving our metta and improving our developing our consciousness to that next stage, but we're also laying very important groundwork for the later development of insight. That ability to be able to watch, to observe, to know anything without favouring or opposing. So the neutral person doesn't have to be somebody who you don't have any feelings about whatsoever, right? Just has to be somebody who generally you neither particularly like or particularly dislike. It should be somebody who you know reasonably well, okay, but not too well. Because people that we know very well, we almost always have some feelings of like and dislike for. So someone you know well enough to say hello to, someone you know their name, you know, maybe somebody at your work, somebody you study with, somebody at the Buddhist society. But someone, you know, you don't have any, you know, just kind of neutral about. With each of these stages, there's, you know, various tips and guidelines, which again, just sort of general guidelines. But one thing, remembering that the counterpart of neutral feeling is ignorance. Yeah, and so this is the danger of this stage. Okay, the danger at this stage is that mind will fall into ignorance. So don't make it harder for yourself than necessary. Don't do loving kindness. Don't do your third stage for somebody who's very sleepy. I made that mistake. I chose for my third person, my first time I did that, I chose somebody who was very, very kind of lazy and sleepy kind of person. And that made me very lazy and sleepy. Don't choose somebody who's too, like, you know, confused or stupid or something. Don't choose somebody who's doing alcohol or drugs or something like that, because all of these are states on that side of ignorance. So choose somebody who's reasonably alert, reasonably got a reasonable energy to them. One of the, as we do each of the stages of metta, each particular stage has its own potential flaws and potential drawbacks. There's not anything wrong with them, it's just because they're incomplete. The first stage, if you're doing loving kindness for yourself, the flaw of that, or the when that goes wrong, that falls over into narcissism. Yeah, that's where you basically fall in love with yourself. You know the story of Narcissus. Yeah, Narcissus was a very beautiful youth who used to watch his image in the pool of water, in the reflection of water. He saw this image and he thought, oh, who's that beautiful person? And just fell in love and would spend all day gazing at this beautiful person in the water. So when it goes wrong, the first stage tends to fall over into narcissism. The second stage, love and kindness for the loved one. When that goes wrong, it tends to go over into desire. It might be sexual desire, or it might be some other form of desire. It might be just anything, any kind of desire which is on the side of like wanting to get something from that person, wanting to kind of use that person in some way. And the third stage, metta for the neutral person, when that goes wrong, it goes over into the side of ignorance and forgetfulness. What you'll often find is that when you develop metta for oneself, for a loved person, and things seem to be going okay, you start doing metta for a neutral person, and then gradually the energy just fades away and it goes down. And it's all gone. It's nothing spectacular. Right? It's nothing obvious. It sort of disappears without you even really knowing it. Yeah? Sometimes, if that happens strongly, then your mind falls into what they call bhavanga. And bhavanga is a term which is used sometimes in meditation circles in Thailand. What bhavanga means is it's like a kind of a subconsciousness. So your mind sort of drops down to a level which is kind of like it's asleep, but it's kind of below the threshold of ordinary consciousness. It's similar to being asleep, but it's not necessarily exactly the same. And there might be a very, very dim kind of awareness there, or maybe none at all. And the state of bhavanga can be very pleasant, can be very peaceful. And it's very easy to convince yourself, and it's actually quite common for meditators to go into this kind of state and to convince themselves that they're in a state of samadhi, that they've gone into jhana or something like that, when in fact their minds have just dropped down into bhavanga. It's very peaceful, it's very still, there's no thinking, the mind doesn't move, it just stays there. And it's very restful. But it doesn't go anywhere. There's no clarity, there's no mindfulness, there's no brightness, there's no awareness, and it doesn't lead to any wisdom. So actually, when you're doing meditation, as your mind becomes more quiet, gradually the hindrances become more quiet, gradually the activities in the mind become more quiet. The mind kind of becoming more and more peaceful and tranquil. And often the mind will come to like a crossroads. And it really just depends on how much mindfulness you have at that point. And sometimes the mind will sort of go, take the lower road, so to speak. It doesn't have quite enough mindfulness, quite enough awareness, and it'll sort of drop down into this kind of bhavanga state. Yeah. But another time, mind might be very, very similar. Only a slight difference, a little bit more mindfulness. And then the mind can go, take the upper road and then go into samadhi. These things can be very close, but quite different. If you've experienced them, then you realize they're actually completely different. But they seem like they might be similar. So this is not at all uncommon, especially in this stage of metta, that if your mind will drop down into kind of one of these bhavanga states. Now, if that happens to you, then when you come to, when you realize it, which might be after a short time or a long time, then just come back again to the beginning of the meditation, start with yourself or start with a loved person, bring the feeling of metta up and then keep going. Remember, the feeling of metta always has a sense of joy with it. There's always a pleasant feeling. So if you're doing the metta meditation and if the mind goes to a completely neutral feeling, then you've lost that metta. Okay? There always should be some joy to it. Even if the neutral feeling is very pleasant. Yeah, the neutral feeling can be very peaceful and very pleasant. But you've lost that metta. So if the mind goes down into that, as soon as you realize, as soon as mindfulness comes back, then just go back, start again, bring the feeling of metta up again. And you've learnt, you've learnt that, well, I didn't have enough energy, I didn't have enough mindfulness to be able to make that stage. Now, one thing that you can do to help that, One very simple thing to help avoid that problem. You've been forewarned. Okay, you know that this is actually likely to happen. It's very, very common, because the very simple fact is that when we reach the third person, we're doing loving kindness with a neutral person, we simply don't care about them. That's basically the problem. We don't care. And that's why we lose that interest. So you know that. When you start that stage, counteract that tendency by applying yourself with a little bit more energy. Yeah? The tendency of the mind will be to kind of back off and become a bit more lazy and a bit more quiet at that point. So counteract it by saying the words a bit louder to yourself. Pushing the mind onto the object a little bit, with a little bit more effort. Not a lot, just a little bit. So you're conscious about keeping that energy up and keeping that interest, and pay a little bit extra attention to that sense of joy and uplift. Now, if we can do this, if we maintain that for that third person, if we avoid that particular problem, usually developing metta for the third person is not that difficult. Okay, if you can do the first two and the metta is going quite well, then usually you can do the third person, and that's okay. There's usually not too many problems apart from that one that I've just been talking about. So maybe let's do some guided meditation, and we'll try meditating up to that third stage, see how that goes. Can we have the lights down a little bit, please? So sitting quietly, settling into that familiar sense of the body. Checking through the different parts of the body. focused in the heart, you say to oneself the words, may I be happy, may I be happy, may I be happy. Repeating those words again and again and again. May I be happy, may I be happy, may I be happy. Keeping the words steady and even, evoking that wish, that aspiration that we have for our own truth, happiness and well-being. noticing that deep inside, that feeling of metta. That soft, gentle feeling. Hold that feeling, keeping it safe. Letting it spread out, fill up your whole body. To the second stage, keeping the mind just as it is, settled, immersed in the body. You bring up the name of the loved one. May that loved one be one be happy. May that loved one be happy. Keeping the feeling of metta. Loved one be happy. May that loved one be happy. May they be happy. May they be happy. to the neutral person, again keeping in mind just as it is, not changing or moving the mind. May that neutral person be happy. May they be happy. May they be happy. Putting just a little bit of extra effort to articulate the words clearly and apply the mind with focus. May that neutral person be happy. May they be happy. May they be happy. coming near the end of the meditation, from that neutral person back to the loved one. May that loved one be happy. May that loved one be happy. To oneself, may I be happy. May I be happy. Letting the words of metta go, letting the feeling of metta fade away, and allowing the mind to return to a neutral space, empty, open, clear. And with the mind open and clear, just take a minute to reflect and review over how the meditation's gone. What just happened? What were the different stages of meditation like? What was it like when I went to the neutral person? Was there any change in the feeling? What is my mind like now compared to how it was at the start of the meditation? Finally, we can dedicate the merit of our practice. May all beings be happy. May all beings be well. May all beings finally realize Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, so, does anyone have any questions about the talk this evening or about the meditation we just did?
If we keep using the same neutral person, yeah, is there a possibility that he'll become a friendly person?
Ah.
And then we have a new person?
Yes, that's true. Yeah, if we keep using the same neutral person, that's true. You have this problem of neutrality erosion, and unfortunately, they become loved, and then you're stuffed, and you have to start again. So yeah, true. So you have to see that, you know, how you feel at that time. Yeah, yeah. You can also have hatred erosion as well for the disliked person. Yeah. So. So it looks like everyone's too peaceful to have any burning questions at the moment. So I might just read a couple from the basket. Ooh, there's a lot there today. These new ones. We can leave the lights, can't we? Sorry, I have a thing about lights. I like the darkness for some reason. It's like everywhere I go when I teach the Dhamma, everywhere you go, there's all these kind of bright, glaring, fluorescent lights. The first thing I do every time is to say, please, please, can we turn down the lights a little bit? So we turn down the lights and do the meditation. As soon as the meditation's finished, someone leaps up and very helpfully switches on the blaring lights again and goes, no. I've got this conditioning when I was in Thailand at Wat Nanachat and the monasteries we were at, where you know, some places we were at, you just have candlelight, so everything would be done just by the candles that were on the shrine, or even if it was done at the places where they had electricity, they'd still keep it nice and just very subdued. I think it keeps it much more peaceful. Okay. I like this one. Thank you for the wonderful talks and teachings, just right. Oh, good. I'll keep that in my warm and fuzzy collection. What are you laughing at? I have a warm and fuzzy collection, okay? I keep them in my room at the monastery, and when things get too much, I pull them out and look at them. It's true. Okay. However, underlined. Do you have any insights on the attainment of bliss, in capital letters, through chocolate and gummy snakes? It is wonderful that they are allowed in the evening. Does the Vinaya say anything specific about gummy snakes? Do the commentaries throw any light on the heads first, tails first, or blue versus red questions? Perhaps Ajahn Teddy could comment. So thank you, dear questioner. So actually the whole thing about what people eat in the afternoon, often this is something which is a bit throws people at first. They're like, you know, especially it's good for the kids. They're like, you can't have dinner, but you can have chocolate. Oh, terrific. Can I be a monk? But the point of that, when in the Buddha's day, just to explain for those who are not familiar, the Buddha the Buddha didn't like making rules. And so he originally practiced, and he said, well, look, you know, this is how I practice, and you know, I enjoy it, so you know, it's a good example to follow. And many of the monks would do that, but some of them didn't. And so the Buddha eventually made the rule disallowing eating afternoon. And but then they found that sometimes the monks would get ill or tired or feeling very hungry or something in the evening, and so there's a sort of complex chapter in the Vinaya, the Code of Monastic Discipline, that then goes through various kinds of allowances of things which the Buddha allowed in the afternoon. For example, fruit juice is one example. Various kinds of medicines, like say ginger, basil, and so on, were all allowed as these kind of medicinal products in the Ayurveda. One of the things which the Buddha allowed was called five medicines, Sapinavanitang Telang Madhupanitang, which is ghee, butter, oil, sugar, and honey. And so these were things which were considered to be, as it's described in the Vinaya, considered to be food but not solid food. So there's something which you can have a bit of in the evening, which maybe give you a bit of energy or help to remove the feelings of hunger, but wouldn't be kind of solid or substantial food. You can't make a meal out of them. So these various kinds of things which the Buddha allowed. So of course these days we have, you know, many other kinds of foods which are different from what was available in ancient India. And so there comes, you know, people make judgments about what's kind of similar to those things which were allowed and what things are dissimilar. And different communities will make different kind of judgments on that and allow or disallow various kinds of things. So even though it seems a bit random what's actually allowable and what isn't, and it is a bit random, I have to admit, but it's just one of those things which has its sort of complex history to it. We can sit and sort of discuss the ins and outs of whether cheese is allowable and these kinds of things. I'm part of the anti-cheese faction, just in case if anybody has a problem with cheese. I think eating cheese in the afternoon is evil. But others beg to differ, and that's okay. I'm sure they'll enjoy their cheese in hell. Okay. Next question. Blah, blah, blah. Okay, so this is a somewhat technical question, a somewhat complex one. In this morning's talk, we talked about the Brahma Viharas being more, I can't quite make out that word, something more, I can't make that word out, that's something than the jhanas. Therefore, they're mentioned later in the suttas. But isn't that about how the Buddha tends to talk? For example, in the Four Noble Truths, suffering, why we suffer, the end of suffering, and how do we suffer, the path. Sorry, how do we get out of suffering? Not how do we suffer, but how do we get out of suffering? And then he talks in a deductive way, so it makes sense that he talk about first jhanas and then how to get jhanas. Okay, through the four divine abodes. The Buddha encouraged people to inquire what's the issue and then how to resolve it. So it's quite a nice little point there that in the Four Noble Truths, it doesn't mention sort of the path first and then the goal of the path. It mentions the goal and then says, well, how do you get there? So the suggestion is that by mentioning the Brahma Viharas after the jhanas that maybe have the same kind of meaning, then it's mentioning the goal is to practice jhanas and the method is to do the Brahma Viharas. There's something... perhaps something to that, but the problem with that is that when the Brahma Viharas are mentioned after jhanas, often, and as I mentioned yesterday when this question came up, often this is irregular in the Pali suttas, but in the Agama suttas of other schools, especially Sarvastivadin, it's the normal sequence, is you have first the jhanas, then the Brahma Viharas, and then the formless attainments. And so the formless attainments are clearly meant to be sort of more advanced than the four jhanas. So the insertion of the Brahma Viharas there would tend to support that particular hypothesis. The other problem with the idea which is suggested here is that the description of the Brahma Viharas, the standard description in there, is clearly talking about not so much a method, like the Metta Sutta is talking about a method of practicing metta. The standard passage on the Brahma Viharas that we're talking about is clearly describing a state of consciousness which is already an exalted state of consciousness. Chetasa vipulena mahagatena apamanena verena, that mind which is exalted, immeasurable, made great without hatred or ill will, and which is spread across the whole world. So it's clearly talking about an advanced state of mind rather than a kind of a path to get to that state. So, I think the issue is still... I think most likely that they're really talking about... that's just a different way of describing the state of jhana. That's my own opinion, but there are different ways of reading that. Okay, next question. Desire is one of the factors giving rise to suffering. Maybe. However, some people thrive on desires in life in a good way, as it gives them hope or a sense of fulfillment. How can we reconcile this in the Buddha's teaching? Well, I used to have this problem when I first heard about this idea in Buddhism, and I thought, well, if you can have an arahant, someone who doesn't have any desire, how could they get out of bed in the morning? What happens when they need to go to the toilet? I mean, you have to want to go to the toilet. But it's true, isn't it? You have to have a desire to do that. But that's not what it means. That's not what the tanha in the Second Noble Truth means. And always come back to what the actual definition is in the suttas. Yayang tanha bono bhavika is that craving which leads to future rebirth. This is what's talking about. Any of that craving which is connected with rebirth, this is the Second Noble Truth. That craving or that desire to do good, the desire to practice the Eightfold Path, the desire to meditate, the desire to help others, the desire to give, the desire to share, all of those things. These are not these desires connected which bind us up to rebirth and bind us to suffering. So none of them count under the Second Noble Truth. So it's not true that Buddhism says you should get rid of all desires, and this is quite standard and quite frequently mentioned in the suttas. If you look in the Pali suttas, it's constantly mentioning that, you know, a certain arahant or the Buddha sort of had this wish to do this or had this desire to do that or wanted to do this or that or the other. And it's mentioned in a perfectly normal, matter-of-fact way. And the Buddha will say to Ananda, you know, come on, Ananda, let's go here. You know, I want to go to such and such a place. And it's not an issue. These ordinary desires to do things, this is not what it means in the Second Noble Truth. So part of what the practice it means then is that our practice is to learn to discern what that actually means. What are those desires which are actually connecting us with suffering and leading us to suffering in the future? Yeah, so that's what we have to learn. Okay, question here. Could I kindly mention again what are the things we have to focus on when doing metta for oneself? I'm not entirely sure what the question's getting at there, but if it's talking about what the basics of the method are, when doing metta for oneself, you start with the words of metta, making them clear and distinct and even, and then the meaning, and then look for the feeling of metta. Hold and establish the feeling of metta, spread it through your body until you feel the feeling of metta even and saturated through your whole body. That's the essential process of that first stage of metta. So I'm not quite sure if that answers the question or whether it was looking for something else, but perhaps if that doesn't answer the question properly, that someone, you can put another bit of paper in tomorrow. Okay. Is it possible to allocate some time in the evening talks for guided meditation? That's what I've been doing every night. I'm not quite sure what the question is. This question, during the metta practice, when wishing metta to a loved one, do you also follow the various sub stages, if you like, i.e. reflecting on the meaning of happiness, focusing on metta in the body and so on? So no, you don't have to do all those things. They're all kind of established as we go along. By the time you come to do metta for the loved one, the feeling of metta should already be well established, and you just keep your attention on that feeling. Okay, all those other things are already there, and they're kind of going along in the background, but the feeling of metta should be in the foreground, and just keep your attention on that. Okay. Do I only teach metta, or do I teach other courses such as vipassana, etc.? When I'm doing meditation retreats, I tend to teach metta. I'm just trying to think if I've done I don't think I've actually have taught a meditation retreat doing something other than metta. I do practice other meditations and I do teach them, but when I'm doing the retreats, I like to focus mainly on metta, for the very simple reason that there's lots of teachers teaching vipassana and there's lots of teachers teaching breath meditation. So why not try doing something a little bit different? So that's why I mainly focus on the metta. Yeah? And of course, if you're, there are a lot of teachers who teach the mindfulness and vipassana techniques. And if you're living in Perth, of course, you are very lucky to have Ajahn Brahm, one of the world's best teachers, especially on breath meditation. So hopefully by focusing on the metta, I can bring something a little bit different. Okay, so there's a few other questions in here, but there may be a few too. It's getting a little bit late, so I might leave them for tomorrow. So for now, let's finish up by paying respects.